Welcome, everybody, to the F-Ball NFL Podcast. I'm your host, Andrea Hengst. I cover the National Football League at sportsonearth.com, thecomeback.com, Vice Sports, and I cover the Cleveland Browns for scout.com's Orange and Brown Report. I am joined, as always, by my co-host, Brian.
Hey, what's going on?
A lot of things are going on because finally training camps are open all around the league, all 32 teams reporting to their respective summer camps, which means this is the first time since the Super Bowl that teams are out there doing football things with not just helmets, but also pads and contact and all of those wonderful things that occur in the 6 weeks prior to the start of the regular season.
Absolutely. I was going to say welcome back to you, but then I think we should say welcome back football.
Welcome back football.
Football is back.
Football is back.
Kind of. There's like people in throwing of pigskins on the screen.
There's 16 straight hours of live coverage of training camps around the league every day on the NFL Network. So I'm going to consider football to be, for all intents and purposes, back. And we are going to talk a little bit about training camp. Obviously, it's just in the opening days for all of these teams, so not a lot of information coming out at this point. We will talk a little bit about some of the bigger storylines here shortly. But let's first talk about two big news items in the NFL this week. First, our long national nightmare is over. We've been waiting patiently/impatiently since the start of free agency for the New York Jets and quarterback Ryan Fitzpatrick to come to some sort of agreement for at least the 2016 season, and they finally did an 11th-hour deal on Wednesday evening, about an hour or so before the first meetings of training camp and about 12 hours before the first practice. Ryan Fitzpatrick back with the Jets on a one-year, $12 million deal. Yes, quite like Von Miller a few weeks ago, Ryan Fitzpatrick got exactly what he wanted.
National emergency might be a stretch.
It's a New York media-based football team.
I know the New York media thinks it's a national emergency, but...
Well, as somebody who's been watching this situation unfold and waiting to see when exactly Ryan Fitzpatrick would end up getting that $12 million deal that I knew for months now that he was after and was probably going to ultimately get.
Well, it didn't make any sense because it wasn't really going to change much about the 1 year. It was that's the difference is what they offered him before was a couple years, and he wants to be a free agent after this
year,
which makes perfect sense. And it just kind of begs the question, what the hell took so long? I mean, why if they were willing to pay him $12 million for this year 3 months ago, you know, why did it take until this week to for them to agree to just have this 1 year in the contract and that's
because
it?
Because it got down to the 11th hour, and there was a point where negotiations completely broke down. There was a point where Ryan Fitzpatrick wasn't even responding to Brandon Marshall's text messages, which was something that Brandon Marshall expressed publicly distress about. and it did come down to not really the $12 million for 2016, but the overall length of the deal. I mean, granted, yes, Ryan Fitzpatrick has been in the league a long time. This is, what, his sixth team, something like that. He'll be 34 years old in November. But 34, I mean, we've seen quarterbacks with long competing spans, especially lately. Peyton Manning, Tom Brady, Brett Favre. So I can understand, granted, that for now at least, Geno Smith, Bryce Petty, and of course Christian Hackenberger in the mix, that, you know, Fitzpatrick doesn't want to just relegate the next couple of years of his career as a backup/mentor to Hackenberg. Granted that Hackenberg is the plan for the future there, and that he'd like to bet on himself and see if he can get a starting job elsewhere. And the Jets were kind of balking at the idea of him being elsewhere, but not necessarily committed to him being a starter beyond 2016. But, you know, deadlines spur action. And, you know, I was on the radio with Fox Sports a week or so ago, and they asked me, you know, when do you think this deal gets done? And I basically said, if it doesn't get done before the start of training camp, I don't think it's going to get done because they just don't have time for that distraction. You just move forward with Geno Smith, and it is what it is.
Right.
And they got it done, you know, basically at the deadline. And, you know, Ryan Fitzpatrick, yes, older guy, journeyman, Last year was the first year he's had sustained success through a 16-game season. But he did have a career high in yards, passing yards. He threw 31 touchdowns to 15 interceptions while only getting sacked, I think, 19 times. So I think that's a pretty good year. I think that says a lot about the Jets organization. It says a lot about the quality of receivers, such as Marshall and Eric Decker. It says a lot about the quality of the offensive line. And it says a lot about Fitzpatrick's status as a savvy veteran in this league.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the thing, is he finally got a situation that was set up really well for him last year, and he played really well. And
the Jets were knocking on the door of a playoff spot.
Right, and that gives them the best opportunity to do anything this year, because if you put, I mean, maybe Geno's older and wiser now and can do something.
Sure.
I don't know. The kids aren't going to do anything. So this is, this was the only, I mean, unless you're banking on Geno being the guy all of a sudden, which there hasn't been any signals of that for the last few years.
They sort of resigned themselves to the idea of that being the case in 2016, but I wouldn't exactly say that they were going rah-rah Geno.
Nobody would. Yeah, they weren't happy about that idea, and like I said, this was all just about a matter of the length of time that they're going to have him tied up, and. He's, he did a good job for you last year. You're going to pay him that much this year, and you were willing to.
Right, which is standard market rate for, I consider, a low-tier starting quarterback, especially when you're talking about $20 million, $18 million average per year becoming par for the course and not this, blockbuster kind of contract that it was just 5 or 6 years
right,
ago.
Right.
And, and maybe it was a fluke. Maybe 2015 was an outlier and not a sign of Fitzpatrick finally being in a situation that suits him. But at the same time, the last time Geno Smith was a prolonged starter back in 2014, he threw 13 touchdowns to 13 interceptions.
Right.
And even if he has improved in the year since, is it the same kind of improvement where it's equivalent to what you could get on and off the field with Ryan Fitzpatrick? And on top of that, you have young quarterbacks there. I mean, if Geno Smith doesn't stick around, right now he's the number two on the depth chart, but if they want to just hold on to Bryce Petty and Hackenberg, or put Bryce Petty on the practice squad and have Hackenberg as the number three, you have an established veteran quarterback who's had success in multiple areas around the league, particularly with the Jets last year, who can help bring along these younger guys while also serving as the starter, which is something he said he's willing to do. I'll be a mentor if I can be the starter too.
Yeah, it's just the Jets without Fitzpatrick this year would feel like a rebuilding year.
Yes.
The Jets with Fitzpatrick feels like
a bridge quarterback.
It feels like they have a shot to go to the playoffs again.
Yeah, and at the very least have a bridge quarterback that has proved effective for them, at least for one season. And I mean, I guess it's only fair to assume that he can keep it up. I mean, I know that there are many reasons why he probably will regress in some areas. I mean, I don't see 31 touchdowns to 15 interceptions being like a sustainable thing for a quarterback of his history. But at the same time, why break up the band? Why?
I mean, he's never
turn
been
away from something that did work.
He's never been a terrible quarterback. He's always been just kind of like okay wherever he's gone.
Sure.
He's like, good enough to like to rely on to be your quarterback, but not good enough to like
be the guy.
Yeah, be the guy that you want there for years to say that this is who our guy is for a while now. And so it was never quite enough of a sell, But like like I said, then he gets to New York last year and put together the year that he did. And I mean, it makes perfect sense for them to bring him back for 1 year. I don't know what the second year of the deal proposed was, but
the initial thing was, I think, something like 3 years, 23.6, and $12 million of that salary would be.
So it was just the first year,
and then it would either be an easy cut next year or backup money.
Right. And so
we're starting him for super cheap, which is also something that he's not comfortable with, obviously.
Right.
I mean, you don't want to turn.
I mean, it makes the most sense for him.
Someone,
obviously.
A veteran into a Tyrod Taylor just because you think you can.
Yeah, it makes the most sense for him, obviously, to get the 1 year deal, because then he can be a free agent again next year.
Sure.
And he can leverage his success, any success he has in the field this year, into potentially another payday next year,
whether
and,
with the Jets or elsewhere.
Right. And I guess that's really the only win for them, if he would have agreed previously to the first deal, is that they wouldn't have to go through this next year. And then, but then they hold all the cards. Then they can just cut him. He's not going to make anything. And he's got to go find a team last
right.
second, you know.
And,
where
and plus the New York Jets are going to have an insane number of cap commitments taking hold next year. So who knows what their money, their financial ability to spend on a quarterback who isn't relatively inexpensive like
right.
Hackenberg is going
right.
to be anyway. Another thing that I think is really curious about this is earlier this week, the Los Angeles Rams released quarterback Nick Foles after the trade market for him did not materialize. And I'm really curious if Foles being on the market kind of spurred a little bit of action with the Jets and with Fitzpatrick in the sense that maybe the Jets were worried that the Rams might have some sort of interest and be able to pay Ryan Fitzpatrick, or that Fitzpatrick was nervous that the Jets could bring Nick Foles in.
So
and
it kind
so
of
maybe,
spurred everybody into action.
And, I mean, that's only speculation.
Yeah,
this is
sure.
just off the top of my head.
But when you have another
quarterback hitting the market at this time of the year, given the situation with the Jets and Fitzpatrick, I wouldn't be surprised if that was a little like, well, maybe we should – just, you know what I mean? So
yeah.
that not so they don't lose out on Fitzpatrick, potentially, that Fitzpatrick doesn't lose out to getting a deal done with New York. And I'm not saying that that was the case, but...
And
know,
I don't think Foles is as good as Fitzpatrick
anyway.
No,
I don't think
so
either. I mean, I think that there are situations in which Foles can play well. We saw it in Philadelphia.
Well, he basically had the 1 year in Philadelphia, and I don't think he played...
I don't think
he even played the whole year.
Right, and he has a more limited overall ceiling, in my opinion,
mm-hmm.
than Ryan Fitzpatrick, even though Fitzpatrick is obviously older.
Right. Well, no, I definitely think that's possible. You know, obviously it's hard to say with certainty, but it's possible that him coming available could have propelled that thing forward. But regardless, the Jets have their quarterback. He's got a place to play this year. And
it's
I think
a win-win.
And everybody,
nice for 2016.
Especially Brandon Marshall, is happy.
Oh, I bet. moving on to another one of the top stories of the week. Erstwhile Browns wide receiver Josh Gordon received his reinstatement from NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell while he will be serving a 4-game suspension to start the season. Goodell is taking a different approach with the marijuana-related punishment here with Josh Gordon. In case anybody's kind of forgotten, Josh Gordon's been suspended numerous times, including for the entirety of the 2015 season, mostly for failed drug tests related to marijuana. There was also a time where he violated the rules of his enrollment in the substance abuse
program
because
yep.
he drank alcohol. He had another failed drug test earlier in the spring when he first applied for reinstatement. Goodell said that he could reapply again on August 1st. At that point, it seemed like a long shot that Gordon would get back to the league in time because if, let's say, that meeting took place on August 1st, Goodell still has up to 60 days to make a ruling, which would take us well into the season, and Josh Gordon would be just so behind in learning the Browns' offense or learning any offense that it might be difficult for him to play again this year. But this time around, Roger Goodell took a kinder, gentler approach, meeting with Gordon before that August 1st deadline, acting quickly within 6 or 7 days to reinstate him. You know, there are terms of this reinstatement. He has to be involved with treatment programs in Cleveland, you know, helmed by the Browns, being mentored by Jim Brown. These programs have to be approved by the Browns organization and the NFL. But as long as they have that approval, he can participate in training camp immediately. They must have gotten that approval. He was with the Browns for training camp today, though he is starting on the PUP list with a little bit of a quad injury. But he's also allowed to spend that 4-week suspension with the team, which is something drastically different from any other suspension that we've seen in a long time. Perhaps a precedent-setting move right here by the NFL, because so many people within the Browns organization pointed to Gordon's 10-game suspension back in 2014 and his inability to have any contact with his coaches, his teammates, to be at the facility as something that isolated him from being able to get the kind of support and football family help that would have really benefited him. So after meeting with Josh Gordon, Roger Goodell has determined that staying with the Browns organization, even if he can't practice and participate in games during that suspension, would be the best thing for him. I tend to agree. And I'm really curious to see, you know, if Josh Gordon can kind of make good on this very final chance that the league has given him. And if so, if that alters Goodell's approach to especially, you know, substance abuse, marijuana suspensions and the discipline he hands out in the future, the type of discipline.
Yeah, no, it's I think it's good for Gordon, obviously. You know, he's going to get another shot here. And
I have to make it clear, this is not a fresh start. I mean, you know, one more strike and he's banned from the league for life. I mean, this is an unprecedented kind of chance that he's being given here.
So, yeah, it's like I said, it's good for him because it certainly seemed up until the last thing, whatever that came out earlier this year.
Yeah, in March.
Yeah,
March,
it certainly seemed like, you know, he was doing everything he should in his time away.
Everybody's worried that he's hanging out with Johnny Manziel, though. But he did clarify today to reporters that he does consider Manziel a friend, but he does acknowledge that they're on different paths in life.
Which
but
is
that he
important
won't,
for
he
him
won't
to recognize.
Stop supporting
certainly.
His friend.
Hey, you know what? Yeah, that's. I mean, he's allowed to have friends, and obviously
people are supporting him. Jim Brown has
made
mistakes in the past, and he's reaching out and mentoring Josh Gordon. So
exactly.
And pay it forward, right?
Right, and you know, as long as he can keep things separate, you know, and if you know, because who knows what Johnny's doing right now, and.
Right.
I don't think anybody even wants to know right now.
No.
But yeah, you know, if he's going to be friends with him, that's not a problem. I mean, just whatever, as long as it's not going to influence what he needs to do. But I definitely think this is good for him that he's going to get. He's obviously at camp. He's going to be able to get back in the swing of things. He's going to miss those games, but like you said, he's not going to be isolated from the situation.
Right.
Plus, this isn't 2014 Browns that he would be away from.
No, yeah, this is a more supportive.
This is probably a better situation for him from a team perspective,
too. There's not this weird pile of political stuff that's going on between the coaches and the front office and all that stuff that he walked back into after that 10-game suspension 2 years ago.
Right, exactly. Or at least we don't know anything about it yet.
True.
But no, I'm assuming that it's just the whole culture within the you know the clubhouse and all that is different and better and definitely could be the type that is very supportive and sets him up to you know come back and stake his claim at the top of that receiving core.
Exactly. I mean,
cause that,
you got to remember back in 2013, even though Gordon served a 2-game suspension to start that season, he was the league's leading receiver with 1,646 yards and 9 touchdowns.
Yep.
Averaging 18.2 yards per reception. I mean, when he's on, he is.
Man, you've looked
at
those stats way too much.
When he's on, he really is one of the top wideouts in the NFL.
Yeah, we saw what he could do for sure.
And
you know?
And if he can kind of shake off that rust and make a difference on the field for the Cleveland Browns and keep his head right. I mean, that's a really good situation when we're also talking about a round one draft pick in Corey Coleman. You're talking about Gary Barnage. You're talking about, you know, the versatile weapon that is Duke Johnson, all these other young receivers, Terrell Pryor and whatever his role in that receiving core shakes out to be. So all of a sudden, there's a distinct possibility, depending on what happens at the quarterback position, which, by the way, Hugh Jackson said he will decide upon before week one of the preseason. Depending on how that shakes out at the quarterback position, at the very least, on paper right now, looks like whoever that guy is going to be is going to have a really nice group of weapons to work with all of a sudden. So
well, yeah, you know, it should be fun to watch that develop.
Another AFC North team that looks to be perhaps without a key weapon to start the season for the first 4 games, just like Josh Gordon, is Pittsburgh Steelers running back Le'Veon Bell. It's been reported that he has missed multiple drug tests during the offseason, and of course, as we've brought up before on this podcast, a missed drug test is like the same thing as a failed drug test to the league. Bell claims it's because he changed his phone number, and so he never got notification of the drug test that he missed. Though I will say that he said back in June or something that he didn't skip any drug tests, and there were reports of him skipping drug tests like dating back to March, and he said that wasn't the case. But now he's not really commenting much on it, just saying that he doesn't want to be a distraction to the team. But head coach
he's
Mike
trying
Tomlin
trying to stay focused.
Yes, focus. Guys, it's a terrible song. I'm sorry. Le'Veon Bell is a great running back.
But he's not a good rapper.
He's a great receiver, and he can block really well and stuff. And he should just do things like that. Or have other interests other than, you know, music, because it's not his forte.
Sorry, I didn't mean to digress there.
We digress. Anyway, head coach Mike Tomlin has said that it's going to be a couple more weeks until Bell's appeal is heard. Bell has said that he's confident because this is more of a communication mix-up than a violation of the – it's a violation maybe of the letter of the law, but not the spirit of the law.
Right.
And at the very least, somebody – I mean, if Le'Veon Bell is an agent, I would assume that if Bell changes his phone number and he tells his agent, maybe if Bell doesn't contact the league about that, wouldn't his agent? So maybe this is just – like I said, you know, and like Bell's trying to maintain some type of communication breakdown.
Yeah, potentially. You know, it's hard to say, especially when they're so finicky about that stuff. You know, like,
yeah, oh yeah.
You know, you miss it, it's the same as failing one. So, I don't know. It's hard to say what happened. And of course, now it ends up with he's suspended for 4 games, and you know, it just shows that this NFL drug policy is something else.
It really is. I mean, it's quite arbitrary. Obviously, you know, even in 2014, when they raised the threshold of nanograms per liter or whatever of THC that could be found in a player's urine, they raised it from 15 to 35. Major League Baseball is at 50. The, you know, WADA, who tests for the Olympics, the World Anti-Doping Agency, they're at 150.
Yeah.
So it's like even when the NFL agreed to, you know, raise
ease,
that threshold.
Ease up on it a little bit.
Ease up on it in exchange for the NFLPA agreeing to HGH testing. It's still quite a
strict
threshold.
It's still the most discerning. Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
It's still quite a strict threshold. But I would assume, especially if Josh Gordon can handle himself while given this kind of special treatment, really, and this becomes the norm for discipline for marijuana violators, we could really see something change drastically once CBA negotiations begin, because CBA expires after the 2020 season, which is going to be here before we know it.
Oh,
and
boy.
So you know they're going to start talks soon. So this might be an interesting jumping off point for there to be a little bit more compromise on the NFL's part when it comes to marijuana use in the NFL and punishment and discipline and all that.
Yeah, well, I mean, especially if, like, you know, not to get too off football here, but especially if, like, the whole marijuana legalization movement, if you want to call it a movement, you know, continues to make progress by then. And it's, you know, more and more legal through more and more places in the United States. It's going to be harder to defend that, because then it just looks like you're trying to control people, you know what I mean?
Right.
For no reason.
Right.
So.
So training camps, as we have said earlier in the show, are underway, and there are a few things to talk about, but none of them we're going to go too in-depth on except for one thing, which is the quarterback situation for the New England Patriots. There are a lot of players, high-profile players, ranging from Jamal Charles to J.J. Watt to Joe Hayden to myriad others that are opening training camp on the physically unable to perform list, the PUP list. That's not uncommon for the start of training camps, especially when you're talking about guys coming back from significant injury like Jamal Charles or a guy like J.J. Watt who just underwent back surgery, or just veterans that they want to ease back in from otherwise nagging or minor offseason injuries. So we'll focus more on PUP lists as training camp wears on and we see who comes off of it and who remains on once we get closer to preseason games. But I just want to talk about the Tom Brady situation because, as we all know, Tom Brady and the NFLPA decided to just stop fighting the league about this Deflategate nonsense and accept that 4-game suspension to start the season. That means Jimmy Garoppolo will start those first 4 games. He and Tom Brady are splitting first-team reps. This is essentially the first time Tom Brady's ever had to do that at length since being the starter in New England. And I saw some reports from training camp today that Brady's a little peeved about it. I'm sure he understands why it's the case, but He's none too pleased. But obviously, Brady will take over in week 5 at Cleveland. There's absolutely no reason to consider, even if Jimmy Garoppolo lights it up for those first 4 weeks of the season, he's not taking that job. That doesn't happen. But what I think is really interesting here is they're getting Garoppolo ready for these 4 games, and they're doing it, you know, early. And by Brady agreeing to take the suspension, they can get Garoppolo with that first team, get him up to speed. But what I think is interesting is the four games that Garoppolo is going to have to be playing in. So the first game, it's at Arizona in week one. But the rest of the games are in New England. However, two of those games are against the Buffalo Bills and the Miami Dolphins, divisional teams that if Garoppolo and the Patriots falter against them, that puts them in a divisional hole by the time Brady comes back. Does it not?
I mean, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, obviously.
Sure. I wouldn't worry about it too much. I mean, I know the statistics hold as far as, you know, you go if you start off 0-4 or something like that. It's hard to
bounce back.
I don't know what the numbers are off the top of my head, but regardless, it makes things a lot more difficult. It's not as easy to get to the playoffs with a bad start like that. But the flip side of it is that, you know, you're even if that does happen, you've now given a 39-year-old quarterback, arguably the greatest ever. I mean, I'm not saying I think he's that.
He's among the greatest of all time, you know.
And arguably the greatest quarterback ever. You've given him the month of September off.
Yeah.
You've taken 4 weeks off of his season at the
and
beginning.
And off of his arm.
At the beginning.
And off of him getting hit.
Absolutely. And so, I mean.
And it's not like he's going to be unprepared to play.
And I don't expect the Patriots to go on four. I think that they'll at least win one or two of those games. And, yeah, I mean, if they're 2-2 and here comes Tom, it's October and here comes Tommy back and he's ready to take the helm. I mean, he could be fresher than he's been in years when it gets to the end of the season, and that could actually end up being helpful for them, you know, in a way, at least in a way.
But I want to bring up one thing. So Danny Kelly wrote a column for The Ringer this week talking about the teams that are the most consistently high performing in the NFL right now, and the Patriots are, of course, one of them. Over the last 5-6 years, they've been a top five team in DVOA on offense. On defense, a little bit more mediocre, somewhere in the 10 to 15, 16 range.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, there's a lot of question marks on the Patriots' defensive line going into the season. A lot of stuff they need to iron out over the next 6 weeks. When you take Brady out of that equation, I mean, yes, you still have Danny Amendola. You still have Julian Edelman. Obviously, Rob Gronkowski. They bring in Martellus Bennett also in the offseason. So you have a lot of players and weapons at Garoppolo's disposal. But at the same time, Jimmy Garoppolo is not Tom Brady. And when you look at those differences in DVOA, and while they've remained stable over the last few years, allowing the Patriots to be such a dominant team year after year, they're leaning so much more on their offense than they are on defense. And when you have some question marks on the defensive front, and the main reason why you've performed so well on offense has a large part to do with the guy under center.
Sure.
Does that make you a little bit nervous about the 4 weeks with Garoppolo? Does that make you a little bit more erring on the side of maybe 0-4 is a little bit more possible than you'd think?
I mean, I'd say 0-4 is more possible than 4-0. I'd say it's more likely than 4-0. But
just
I don't.
That Arizona game, to go to Arizona in week one, I just can't see the Patriots winning that game.
That's going to be really tough.
It would be tough with
that's
Tom
gonna
Brady.
It's going to be really tough. Yeah, it'd be tough enough with Tommy.
Yeah.
And like, so then, you know, you look at the other, then there's home games. I mean,
Houston's one of those home games that they're playing, and you can't. I mean,
you also have to look at who we're talking about here.
But J.J. Watt's coming off of back surgery, granted. But in week three, J.J. Watt is going to be going after Jimmy Garoppolo. What is that? What dynamic is that going to
have? And you know, Buffalo proved to be pretty good last year.
Miami's trying out. Trying out with Adam Gase right now. We don't know exactly.
What we're going to see out of Miami. There's talent there, but what they're what can they do with it? It remains to be seen.
There for years, and it's never really.
So that's what I'm saying. I have to look at who we're dealing with as a whole here. Because yes, you take Tom Brady out of the situation, it's a different story. But we're still talking about a team. We're talking about a team. We're talking about the ultimate team sport.
Sure.
We're talking about a team that's one of the class of the league as far as being an organization, how they run things.
8 years in a row, divisional champs.
And it's Bill Belichick. I mean, I would lean on Bill Belichick in any argument about the first 4 weeks of the season.
Good point. Yeah, absolutely.
And just say,
that's
Bill Belichick's going to find a way to win at least one or two of those games.
Yeah, no matter who your personnel is on the field,
exactly.
That Bill Belichick as the coach is already an advantage.
Exactly.
All right, we're going to take a quick break here at the F-Ball NFL podcast, and we're going to come back. We're going to try something different with the divisional preview kind of thing that we typically do this time of year. So we're going to come back. We're going to talk a little bit about the AFC South. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. Back here at the F-Ball NFL podcast, and of course you gotta do some divisional previews. You gotta preview the season this time of year. Now that things are kind of underway, getting the ball rolling on these training camp actions. But instead of a traditional going, you know, really breaking down the team, we're gonna take a nice shallow dive into basically our main thought or concern or question or belief about each specific team in the league going by division. We're calling it one team, one thought. Essentially, it's four teams, four thoughts because we're going by division. But we're going to start this week with the AFC South. Let's start with the Houston Texans. For me, what I've been kind of concerned with over the last couple of days is J.J. Watt's back surgery, which I discussed earlier in the show. Conservative estimates say maybe 10 weeks till he's back and ready to go. Other estimates say 6 to 8 weeks. J.J. Watt, of course, is vowing to get back as quickly as possible, and given that he's a superhuman freak, it's quite possible. But at the same time, you know, he's basically the heart of that team at this point. We don't really know what they have at quarterback with Brock Osweiler. We know that there's a lot of talented guys, you know DeAndre Hopkins and stuff like that. But J.J. Watt is really the motor through which everything kind of runs there. And even if he's ready to come back on the field in week one, is he going to be physically in that 100% full go kind of mode? Because they're going to really need him to have a strong start in order to, get going off on the right foot here. And so that's my main question, is how long really will J.J. Watt's back surgery recovery take? And exactly how long is it going to take from then to when he gets to that 100% full speed J.J. Watt that we all know?
Yeah, I'm less concerned about that just because, he's on track for the beginning of the season. Even if he's not quite 100%, you assuming he doesn't re-aggravate or anything or make anything worse or injure something else, you know, I think that he'll be full speed by the time the season really kicks into gear. And I'm less concerned about injuries that should resolve, like, towards the beginning of the season, you know what I mean? My main question for these guys is what's going on at quarterback, because they just paid a bunch of money to a guy that's played six games.
Seven starts.
Forgot about that last one. And that's what I'm just – I wasn't super sold on Osweiler last year in Denver, and that was a situation where he had a good running game and an outstanding defense. And, I mean, it's similar in Houston as far as they got a pretty good defense on the other side, but I'd say their running game has a little bit more question than Denver did last year.
Sure.
And, you know, for as much as people love to say that, how, you know, Osweiler was better than Manning last year, because we heard that a lot last year, and we've even heard that in people's thoughts about last year, he looked okay. Like, I thought he looked, you know, he didn't look bad, but
right.
he wasn't killing it. And frankly, it was only seven games. I don't know how you can make any kind of statements like that, you know. I guess in those seven games, he looked slightly better than Peyton did. Peyton certainly looked bad at the beginning of the season.
Well, Peyton was injured.
Right. So I'm just saying that Houston goes out and throws a bunch of money at this guy. I mean, 5 years more than Ryan Fitzpatrick just got paid.
Right.
And Fitzpatrick has been in Houston. He's been around, and he's proven to be at least be a capable starter. And maybe Osweiler can get there. Maybe Osweiler is the man. I don't know. And this team has been needing a quarterback for a while, and I kind of feel like they paid one to make themselves think that they have a quarterback.
That's a good point. That's a really good point.
They're paying themselves into convincing themselves into Brock Osweiler. And he could go out there and light it up. He's got DeAndre Hopkins. Like
I'm ready to be wrong, but I'm also ready for him to be
absolutely
Matt Flynn.
Absolutely. If he goes out there and lights it up, great. You know, you guys did a good job. You identified him. You paid him well, and it turned out for you. But I'm just saying that's a lot of money to pay a question mark in my mind.
Next up, the Jacksonville Jaguars. My main thing with the Jaguars is the sheer volume of talent acquisition that they did in the offseason, particularly on the defensive side of the ball, and whether or not it's going to pay dividends. Because I feel like the last three seasons with Gus Bradley, we're waiting for this team to turn a corner. Last year, they certainly did on offense. Blake Bortles having Allen Robinson and Allen Hurns out there to throw to, and it was a very productive offense, particularly in the passing game, not so much in the run game. But the defense was the true liability there. They didn't really generate a lot of pressure up front. They didn't generate a lot of turnovers in the secondary. And so they heavily addressed this in the offseason. They signed Malik Jackson, defensive lineman formerly of the Denver Broncos, safety Tashaun Gibson, formerly of the Cleveland Browns, cornerback Prince Amukamara from the New York Giants. They also added outside linebacker depth, trying to revive some maybe new life in Bjorn Werner's career, after it kind of tanked out in Indianapolis. And then they made a couple of key additions in the draft. In fact, out of their seven draft picks, six were on defense.
Well, they had a coup in the draft.
They
had
a coup in the draft because
they
ended up with Jalen Ramsey, the top cornerback in the draft, considered by many the top player in this draft class. And then in the second round, they were able to get Miles Jack, who slipped down draft boards because they were concerned about his knee. And before there was that concern about his knee, he was right up there with Jalen Ramsey as one of the top players.
Yeah, he was being
draft.
Talked about going to Jacksonville at number five,
exactly.
Not the top of the second round. So definitely a coup there.
Exactly.
Sorry,
so they
finish your thought.
they made some very high profile, high-end acquisitions on defense. And they did make a couple of moves on offense. They brought in left tackle Kelvin Beachum to take over for Luke Jokel. And they brought in running back Chris Ivory to kind of be in that Toby Gerhardt kind of role and hopefully perform better at it than Gerhardt did. And then, of course, Dante Fowler Jr. is coming back from the ACL tear he suffered before the season even started last May. So that's another major part of that pass rush that's there, and he's 100% healthy. So I'm really curious to see if all this new talent on defense can come together. I mean, because you're talking about Gus Bradley, brought in from the Seattle Seahawks as a defensive-minded coach, mm-hmm. and the defense has really struggled there mm-hmm. in the past few years. But this is some high-tier talent, and I feel like, this has definitely got to be make or break for Gus Bradley, because you bring in all of these guys on defense, and then it doesn't get any better?
Well, yeah, and again, it's one of those things where depending on what happens, you know, if they look like they've made a step forward, but they fall short of whatever goal anybody sets for them in their head, you know, does that mean you should move on from Gus Bradley? I don't think so. Just because it's been a slow climb, is my point.
I mean, not entirely a slow climb. I mean, they went from what? 4 wins to 3 wins to 5 wins.
Well, it's been a slow climb as far as looking, just watching them. You know what I mean? When you watch them play. Because last year, they were a different team than they were 3 years ago. You know what
yes.
I mean? And they had what you can consider a functional to more than, I'd say a functional plus to actually a good offense.
Oh, very good offense.
And
especially the passing game. The run
right.
game needs to get
right.
more very precarious.
So I'm just saying that like it's the way that team has been and as miserable as that team has been and has the what they've gone through, like you need to keep building is my point
right.
regardless. And just because that's actually kind of ties into the one point I had for this team, which is just like, you know, can they pull it all together here? And, you know, it's 'cause like you said, they brought in all this defense. The defense was the big issue last year. But you know they're actually being pegged by lots of people as being, you know, the darling,
the preseason
darling for the pick that's going to make that leap, you
sure.
know. And so then that's the question is what's enough of a leap? Do they
is it 7 wins? Is it 9 wins? Is it 11 wins?
Right.
What does it take?
Do they just have to make the playoffs? Do they need to win a playoff game?
Or they just have to win more games than they did last year.
Exactly, and that's what I'm saying is like it comes down to. You know, there are now expectations. So, you know,
how is that going to feed into the whole thing? You know, are they going to be able to live up to?
Yeah, there are expectations now,
right,
because of what that offense did last year and the talent they brought in on defense.
Exactly. So, but that's the question: what is the realistic expectation for that team? And I'd say obviously there's got to be an improvement in wins. They need to have they need to be up around 500 or a little better. If they don't make the playoffs, but they're a 8 or 9 win team, I don't see Gus Bradley losing his job.
I don't see him losing his job for that. Next up, the Tennessee Titans. What I'm curious to see is what happens with Marcus Mariota in year two. They're starting to surround him with a whole lot of weaponry. You know, they brought in DeMarco Murray in free agency, or they traded for DeMarco Murray, drafted Derrick Henry, and then they also have Dexter McCluster and Bishop Sankey right there at the running back position. At wide receiver, obviously Dorial Green-Beckham, Justin Hunter, Kendall Wright, Trey McBride, and the veteran now, Harry Douglas. So those are a lot of guys for Mariota to work with. The question is, you know, how far can he take his next step in his second season? Because the Titans need it. The Titans need it. I still worry about the offensive line. I still worry about that defense. They need something to rally around, and can Mariota be that rallying point in his second year?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think they can, I think that he obviously is the guy that they're going to center around
But will it work?
Will it work to what extent? I mean, will he look, you know, improved?
Can he win them games? Does he look improved? Can he win them games? Can he, you know, bring them out from behind if they're playing from behind in the fourth quarter?
I thought he had a solid rookie campaign.
There were hiccups. I mean, it wasn't as good as Jameis's.
I still think that they're a long-term project. I think that there shouldn't be a whole lot of expectations for Tennessee this year just because there's a lot of things to do that – there's a lot of issues on that team.
Yeah, I mean, they went in and got Marcus Mariota a year ago in the draft and then ended up with the number one pick the following year. I mean, there's more work to be done there than just the quarterback position.
Right, and I guess that you know, that can be my point for this team is just how far can Mariota take them, you know, with whatever influence he has on the team, being just one man. Obviously the most important man on the field when he is, but, you know, it's still – he's just one guy, and there's a whole machine around him that he can't really control, you know?
Yeah, and I'm also not completely sold on the coaching staff. I haven't been sold on coaching staffs in Tennessee for a little while, to be honest.
And they kind of made a change, too, and it still didn't, you know.
That didn't really produce anything either. And then finally, the Indianapolis Colts. Obviously, for me, it's Andrew Luck. It's protecting Andrew Luck. It's building up an offensive line that supports Andrew Luck, a run game that supports Andrew Luck, a group of receivers that support Andrew Luck, and a defense that, you know, can stay on the field and kind of beat up on their opponents a little bit. And I'm just really curious if that's going to really, you know, pan out this year. They've made some moves, particularly on offensive line, but the right side of that line is still a question mark. And when you look at the situation where Jim Irsay could have moved on from Ryan Grigson, Chuck Pagano, or both, and deciding to put them together for another year, and it doesn't entirely look like they've made enough positive decisions that support Andrew Luck, the highest paid player in the NFL, who just got his extension done a few weeks ago. Are they really going to support this quarterback, or else is Irsay going to look stupid for keeping those two decision makers both in place?
Yeah, I mean that's actually a really good question for this one. Is, you know, what this it's basically an experiment. You know, we see this stuff. We see these teams get blown up all the time. We rarely see the situation where we prefer
stuff's not going well, but we're going
to. We want continuity over trying to go in another direction
just
because
we're doing continuity. Work out your problems, guys.
Right,
because you're stuck with each other.
So it was a very interesting move by Irsay, especially tying them together like he did, and because I mean I've thought Pagano was a pretty decent coach for a while. I don't necessarily have great things to say about Grigson.
I don't have great things.
He's made a lot of questionable moves,
sure,
since he's been there. So Pagano's tied to him now. Yeah, you know, they have who they have. I still think that Andrew Luck is one of the best younger quarterbacks in the league. I mean,
of course,
now been in the league for 4 years now, so, or 3 or 4 years now.
Drafted in 2012, baby.
12, yeah. So, like,
You know, I definitely think that he's the type of guy that you want. He's the type of guy that you put him on, you know, half a dozen teams, and I think that it makes him a legit contender immediately. You know, and
oh, totally.
But what can Indy do around him? They've been trying to work out those kinks for the past four years. Right, and we saw him make that steady increase each year, doing a little bit better performance wise. You know, when you get to the end of the year, and they were
but as we were talking about earlier with Tom Brady and Jimmy Garoppolo, it's a team sport, and the team that's been built around Andrew Luck has been more minus than plus.
Right, and then last year obviously he got hurt, and that it just changed the whole picture.
I mean, he missed nine games. I mean, if you're gonna miss mm-hmm. nine games, even if they had a great cast of characters there, I mean, it would still have been tough for the Colts because it's Andrew Luck.
Right. So that's the question for them is, will this experiment work to keep the band together and keep going down this path, which has seemed weird. Because
a weird path.
What looks like an incredible talent at quarterback, which is like one of the hardest things to find in the league, and you just keep doing, you know, you keep moving these pieces around next to him, and you're hoping it works or something.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And you want more hits than misses, and they seem kind of okay with how many misses they've had versus
right.
hits.
Right. But potentially, and this will be my bit of optimism for the Indianapolis Colts this year.
I have lots of optimism for them just because of Andrew Luck.
Well, it's just that potentially when they were going through the process of are we moving on, are we going to keep these guys? Potentially that process helped galvanize this front office.
Perhaps.
And
maybe they're thinking on the same page.
They're going to do things differently as an organization now. Between, and I just, when I say they, I basically mean the relationship between Gregson and Pagano.
Potentially and Irsay, because you have Irsay too, heavily involved
sure.
with
and
running that team.
Potentially they came together and realized that, you know, they can make things work in this way, and maybe it'll work. I don't know.
Yeah.
Potentially.
Well, those are our looks at the AFC South teams. We kind of a couple of thoughts per team, I guess. But
we tried to stick to one thought, but that's the thing is, then you bring yours up, and then I'm responding to
exactly,
some of that. So.
Exactly. but we're going to continue doing these throughout the remainder of the offseason, heading into Week One. So stay tuned next week. The AFC South's counterpart, the NFC South. So stay tuned for that. Ultimately, that marks the end of. Training camp week one, or training camp day one, essentially.
I was going to say, it's like, all the camps are basically starting. So.
Training camp day one episode of the F-Ball NFL podcast. Thank you all for tuning in. We'll be back on a regular weekly schedule now that real actual football things are happening in earnest at all times. I, of course, am your host, Andrea Hanks. I cover the NFL at thecomeback.com, sportsonearth.com, and at Vice Sports. I also cover the Cleveland Browns at Scout.com's Orange and Brown Report. You can find me on Twitter at FBall_Andrea. That's FBALL_Andrea.
And once again, I'm Brian. And in addition to finding me on this podcast and being the co-host and producer of this podcast, you can find me on Twitter at BFAT65. That's at BFAT65.
Football's in the air. We can smell it.
Yes.
Can smell it.
It smells like leather.
It smells like leather and grass.
And pigskins.
And pigskins.
That's just because someone's eating pigskins.
Asper cream.
Over there.
So. So thanks everybody for tuning in to this week's episode of the F-Ball NFL Podcast. We'll be back next week talking all things training camp, NFC South, and more. So stay tuned. Until then, enjoy camps this week. Enjoy the rest of your summer. And we'll see you next week.
Later.
Peace.